It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, it's still a mystery where humans first discovered how to ferment grape juice into wine, but the Republic of Georgia is a strong contender. We'll talk to Gemma Tarlak, who just visited the region and learned about the ancient origins of winemaking.
First, youth suicide is still rare in Wisconsin, but the state experiences the tragedy more often than the national average. County services are supposed to prevent mental health crises from escalating, but a new analysis by USA Today Network Wisconsin shows wide disparities in spending on youth mental health services.
Keegan Kyle is with us now to share more about that analysis and what options are offered in different Wisconsin counties. He's a reporter with USA Today Network Wisconsin's investigative team. Keegan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This analysis, Keegan, is part of the Kids in Crisis series. What piece of the puzzle were you trying to figure out in this analysis?
Yeah, this came out of our 10 town hall meetings that we held across the state after the series launched, where a lot of people said one of their biggest concerns in getting their children linked with services was the gaps between county-provided services. So everyone has access to, or if you have insurance, you have private services that are out there, you have hospital services that are out there, but the county services are supposed to be this last resort gap to make sure that regardless of income, every child has access to treatment. And we are hearing throughout these town hall forums that there were really big differences depending on which county you lived in and how much access you had to those types of services.
And we're talking here about maybe teens, but also in your report, you talk about kids as young as, you know, lower elementary school age. And this is a place where they might have a serious mental health problem, a crisis. If it's not addressed, it could turn into something very dire.
Exactly. So they do a range of different services, you know, preventative services that are hoping to stop children from ever reaching that crisis position, but they can also be kind of come at the end of things and try to bring them back into a more stable environment.
You said you heard from the public in these town hall meetings. We're worried maybe if I happen to live in the wrong county, I don't have access to the services my kid needs. Is that what you found as you crunched these numbers?
So one thing that we tried to look at was this complaint that there were really big differences. So we looked really at funding. And so we got some state data that looked at how much counties were actually setting aside for child, specifically youth mental health services. And then we also collected patient data to show how many children were being treated by counties across the entire state. And then using those two figures, we calculated how much money per patient is being spent. And that's really where we saw some pretty stark differences, even with neighboring counties.
Yeah, talk about some of the differences you saw. And this may not be the whole story, and we'll get into that for the data that's out there. But what did you see when you just crunched the numbers those ways?
Well, there's a so if you go even neighboring counties, you know, one county compared to the next, they might be spending twice as much per patient as the neighboring county. Some counties are spending as little as, you know, less than $1,000 per patient, and others were spending more than $20,000 per patient. And so there are these really big gaps in how this is our what best guess metric kind of trying to get a gauge on how many services are actually being leveraged to help children across the state.
And this is how this works in Wisconsin. The state doesn't step in and do it itself, but it directs the counties to do this. I imagine there's some state or federal aid here and there, but it says counties, you need to provide these services, but the counties are in charge of figuring out how to implement and fund that then.
Exactly. So the counties are really the crucial point of directing services to children. They receive state funding, federal funding, grant funding, and then they also have a certain amount of discretion in allocating their own local dollars towards children's mental health. So in some cases, it is those local decisions that dictates how much access children have to service levels. And that plays into these differences from county to county is the decisions that are made both locally and at state and federal levels.
Talking to Keegan Kyle from USA Today Network Wisconsin, a new analysis shows big disparities in funding for mental health care, crisis care for kids around the state, trying to figure out why that is, what impact it might have. You took this data, Keegan, to people who run some of these programs in counties and at the state level too. What kind of reactions did you get?
A lot of different reactions. At the county level, we were stunned that so many county officials told us that they had huge questions about the accuracy of this data that they had been reporting to the state. Basically, they're concerned that the state's instructions for how to report budget and patient data is so loose that they are inconsistently reporting their numbers, and that is uncomparable. But at the state level, they looked at our analysis and were kind of blown away. They called this a major breakthrough in kind of their understanding of how much children's mental health care is being delivered by counties. And they viewed this as a major stepping stone towards having a more productive conversation about what is the level of care that needs to be provided, and are certain counties failing to meet their children's needs. That's really been a concern that's been lingering out there, but to date, we don't have a lot of information on really what is being provided in our counties and how do those differences play out.
So one of the problems here may just be bad data in a way if counties are all reporting these things differently. Is that viewed as a maybe wonky but important first step to say, okay, let's all report, you know, money spent on the psychiatrists, money spent on this service, that service, and all do it the same way so we know if there's this massive gap in services?
Well, precisely. So one of the biggest questions is the state is essentially directing a huge amount of money towards children's mental health. The counties collectively reported more than about $300 million towards children's mental health over 3 years. But if these reporting mechanisms are really inconsistent, then we don't have a great way of evaluating what methods are effective or not, and really actually analyzing, are children receiving good care in one county or bad care in another county?
So that's a data question in part, but from your reporting, from what you saw from talking to these officials, does a picture emerge that, yeah, in fact, some kids in some counties are not getting vital services there or waiting to get vital services?
Well, I think one thing that this data does, despite the accuracy concerns about its about the data, is that it does bolster the anecdotal things that we've been hearing from parents and clinicians and county officials themselves. They have their own anecdotal observations, believe that there are really wide gaps in county services. So I don't want to say that we should disregard those. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that I do think it does start this conversation at a local level where you can look at the data. If you're a county supervisor, for example, you can look at the data and look at your own budget and start to investigate whether these numbers are lining up, whether the amount of money is meeting where you think it should be.
Let's talk about the anecdotes you heard along the way at the town hall meetings you had. What kind of things did you hear from parents in this situation? Their kid needs some kind of care. It, in theory, is supposed to be provided via their county. What kind of problems were they having?
Well, so one example is the wait list that we mentioned in our story. In some counties, because of the services that they do or they don't provide, they have established wait lists, so families have to wait weeks or months to access certain treatment programs that may be available in another county. So you have sometimes these clinicians who are trying to refer people to other counties where they may be able to get more treatment. And I think that shows in some way how we're, the clinicians that are out there are trying to balance this uneven network across Wisconsin and make things work for families.
In your piece on this, you mentioned the data, and this is from other reporting, youth suicide rates in Wisconsin, not crisis levels, not the worst of the nation, but higher than average and a big concern, obviously, for a lot of people. Is there a sense that if we can fix this, we can get our data better, we can figure out what works, that we can start moving the needle, bringing down that youth suicide rate?
Yeah, there's been a discussion about whether the youth suicide rate is necessarily the best metric to look at youth mental health. So there's this Office of Children's Mental Health that is run through the state government. And one of the things that they're trying to do this year is line up all these different metrics that they can look at children's mental health through. Youth suicide rate will probably be one because it measures the worst scenario, right? But there are all these other rates that they're looking at, like hospitalizations. Are those going up and down? How many kids are utilizing treatment programs? And I think that with those different metrics, they hope to get a better picture on whether spending in one area versus another is really moving that needle or not.
Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
That's Keegan Kyle. He's a reporter with USA Today Network, Wisconsin's investigative team. Joined us to talk about a new analysis of spending on youth mental health services, which varies, according to their findings, very much, depending on which county you live in here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk about people who serve as caregivers, and we often, in those instances, think about adults, but there's also a silent and sometimes hidden group of people who take care of family members. Children. We'll talk about the challenges facing kids who are taking responsibility of caring for family members.
First, the history of wine can be a touchy subject. There are a lot of countries in Southwest Asia that are fighting for the right to say they are the birthplace of wine. One of the contenders for the title, the Republic of Georgia.
Regular science guest Gemma Tarlak took a trip to the nation last month, and one of her stops was to a winery that still uses ancient techniques to make wine. She also stopped at Dimanisi, the oldest hominin site out of Africa, and she chronicled her travels on her blog Dead Things at Discover Magazine. She joins us now to talk about that trip.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello. Always good to be with you.
Well, people in the Republic of Georgia think it might be the birthplace of wine. Scientists maybe do, too. So what's the evidence? Why do we think that this is the place we have to thank for our wine of today?
Well, absolutely. You know, there are a few different reasons, a few different lines of evidence, if you want to call it that. First, you looked at genetically. We think that the first place where grapevines were domesticated is probably also the most diverse place that has the most diverse number of species. Because when you think about it, or subspecies rather, when you think about it, if it's been domesticated and it's in place, it probably had the longest period of time to really diversify genetically. And that's Georgia. There are more than 500 subspecies that grow there naturally. So that tells you right away, okay, maybe it's been there the longest. But archaeologically, there's also evidence. I think it goes back 8,000 years that they found, you know, grape seeds and other residues that they think were used in domestic wine production or domestic grape wine production.
And Gemma, it's pretty remarkable that you can almost get a blast from the past just watching how they make wine in that region today. And you did that. Those ancient techniques are still in play. How does it work?
Yeah, and I love that they're still using it. And in fact, it's undergoing a revival recently because, you know, they call it European production. That's the commercial style of wine production that we're familiar with. And they are very proud of the Georgian style, which, like most Georgian words, no offense to any listeners who speak Georgian, it is tough to pronounce. It's very it's a Q-V-E-V-R-I, super tough to say for an English speaker. But basically, they use these giant clay vessels that can hold hundreds of quarts or, you know, several hundred gallons of wine. And they bury them in the ground, often in a room in a house, because there's a lot of home wine production. And then they pour everything from the harvest into there, you know, the juice, the skins, everything, and they let it sit for a long period of time. They do not introduce yeast into the process because there are already yeasts naturally on the skin of the grapes, and that's all they use. So it's a very kind of natural, no additive process. They let it sit for a long time, which gives their wines a really interesting color. The colors are very deep. You know, red wines in Georgia are actually called black wines because they're so deep and rich in color. Even the white wines have a beautiful, deep amber hue.
Now, Gemma, you're a journalist, and when faced with a winemaking technique going back thousands of years, you put yourself in there in the story, and you tasted it. So what wine made this way, this maybe 8,000-year-old method, taste like compared to the wine we might be familiar with?
Well, it's delicious, but, you know, I wasn't really sure, so I had to try several different kinds, and then, you know, I had to go back and try them again just to make sure that I was, you know, it's all for science, it's all for my readers and my listeners, but seriously, they're really interesting. There is, you know, it all depends really on the variety of grape, because there is a range in terms of sweet, dry, etc., but it seemed to me that the wines I tasted made in this traditional method just had a depth that was really unusual, that I really have not tasted from other, you know, commercially or typically produced modern styles of wine. Really just delicious.
I am not really a wine connoisseur, and I'm curious if I were to sit down with a couple of wines, one from this region in Georgia, one from, you know, the European method, would I be able to taste it? Does it really jump out at you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, wine is such an individual thing. And even if you are into wine, you may not be like a super taster who has an unusually large number of taste buds on your tongue. So you might appreciate things differently whether or not you have a background in wine. But I think certainly if you are like me and you enjoy history and just being there and tasting wine that is probably closer in taste to what people were drinking millennia ago than what you'll find, at your local wine shop, I think that alone is worth it, whether or not you can taste, the different things going on, the different notes and stuff going on in the wine.
Well, Gemma, you did manage in this trip to the Republic of Georgia to tear yourself away from the ancient winemaking techniques for a bit. You went to a place called, I hadn't heard of this before, Dimonisi, and this is one of the oldest early human sites. First of all, who are we talking about? What group of humans are we finding, pre-humans are we finding in Georgia, and why is that unusual?
Well, the interesting thing, Dimonisi is actually the oldest site for the genus Homo, that's our genus, outside of Africa. It's the oldest site that we know of where our ancestors, the earliest members of the genus Homo, were, that we can definitively say, yes, they were here. So that kind of gives you the significance of it, but you asked the $60 million question in terms of exactly what species was there, because that's a point of contention, actually, between paleoanthropologists. Some of them say it was Homo erectus, who is the member of our genus that we thought left Africa first. However, the specific characteristics of the fossils they have found at Dimonisi, and it is an incredibly rich site, they have at least six different individuals, all from roughly the same time period. For early hominid fossils, that is huge. That is wonderful. But they don't have characteristics that we can clearly say, oh, it's Homo erectus or it's the earlier Homo habilis. So right now they're generally classified as kind of a subspecies of Homo erectus, Homo erectus georgicus, reflecting the fact that they were found in Georgia. But we really don't know. And they're still digging. They're still finding things. So hopefully we'll have a little more clarity on the issue. But it's super exciting.
Yeah, I love the part where you write about how you're just looking at the site and you get chills. So what did it feel like to be standing at the feet of something so ancient?
Oh, my gosh. It was wonderful because, it's not just the hominids. I mean, they are a huge and very important thing in Dimonisi. But to get to them, I had a guide. The site manager was walking me through, and he's pointing out, oh, these are the medieval castle walls. These are the Byzantine-era baths. Oh, this is the Bronze Age skeleton we found. So you're going back in time, and then you get to this small, it's about the size of a living room area where they have actually excavated all these hominid fossils. And you could just see it is such a tiny area on this big promontory where you could fit probably 1,000 more areas the size of that pit. And it just tells you there is so much more to find there. There's so much more to excavate. And it's exciting to be in a place where you know there are more exciting finds right under your feet.
We're sharing exciting science finds with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. This is a Republic of Georgia special. She's been writing about her recent trip there. So I want to stay with these Homo erectus-ish people in the Georgia area. Part of the exciting thing here, you write, is that previously we and paleoanthropologists didn't necessarily believe that Homo erectus had the right stuff to survive outside of the environment in Africa, yet we're finding these guys, they're kind of like the Homo erectus in Africa, but with a different set of animals and plants around them, showing that they might have, adapted to a completely different ecosystem.
Absolutely, absolutely, because even though we know the genus Homo came out of Africa, we don't find any of the animals that they would have been hunting and dealing with in Africa itself. There are all kinds of Eurasian species all over Dimonisi. And that's important because it tells you that the hominids had to adapt to those, new predator and new prey. At the same time, there's no evidence that they had, say, advanced stone tool technology. The stone tools they found have been really basic, the earliest stone tool technology. And also, there's no evidence that they had use of controlled fire. So if you can imagine, you're a species that's been living in Africa, and you make your way northward, and you end up in, the Caucasus, in where Europe meets Asia, you're in a mountainous environment. There is winter. I mean, there is several months each year where you do not have access to, say, fruits or vegetables. So you have to adapt, and they managed to do it all without fire. That's incredible when you think of really how we thought Homo erectus spread out of Africa using fire, using advanced stone technology. Turns out that was not the case.
And Gemma, just briefly before we move on to your next unusual finding, one of the questions you are kicking around here is, why doesn't this site get more marquee billing among these world hominid sites? Why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. It could be a lot of different issues, but I think maybe there are some infrastructure issues. The road heading there right now is a little bit rough. I don't want to say on air how rough, because I was driving a rental car, and I don't want the rental company to know, but yeah. I think it's just a matter of people expect to find early hominid finds in Africa. And Dimanisi is on the list of tentative World Heritage Sites for UNESCO. I sure hope they pick it, because it really deserves to have that recognition.
I want to advance our time scale a little bit. You also saw cool stuff from the medieval era. You mentioned some Byzantine ruins, things like that. And you saw an interesting representation of a particular animal on a building. What did you see?
Well, you know, I took this absolutely spectacular hike up into the mountains, the High Caucasus, because there is this famous church there that's very much revered among Georgians. And so I climbed all the way up there, and there is this particular carving around one of the windows dating, you know, from the early medieval period, where I'm looking at the carving, and it looks exactly like two sauropod dinosaurs. Sauropods being, you know, like Brontosaurus. They've got, you know, the long neck, the long tail, and then a big cow body in the middle. And these things, just they look like sauropods. They look exactly like, you know, a child would draw a sauropod. And I did some research on the web. No one really knows what these things are supposed to represent. They could represent some salamanders that are actually in that mountainous area, some alpine salamanders. You know, there's other conjecture that maybe they represent fantastical beasts of some, you know, mythic bestiary that the carver just wanted to depict. And then, you know, there's the question, well, what do they look like? But I want to be clear that I am not suggesting Georgia was full of dinosaurs in the 12th century.
We're about 65 million years off there.
Exactly. I'm not making that suggestion, but it's really interesting to try to put yourself in the mind of, you know, a 12th century stonemason and try to figure out why he chose to carve that particular animal. Mm.
Gemma, thanks as always for being with us.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the little-known and little-talked-about issue of children who serve as caregivers. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a group of nuns made headlines 4 years ago when they went on a road trip through several states as they took on social justice and economic issues. We talked to Sister Simone Campbell, who leads the Nuns on the Bus tour and is kicking it off in Madison.
First, when we think or talk about caregivers, we usually assume that we're talking about adults caring for maybe sick, disabled, or elderly family members. Caregiving, frequently difficult and taxing, people take up the responsibility because they love and want to care for the person who needs that help.
But what many of us may not know is that there's a group of people who also take up the task of caring for a family member, children. And while there's often support for adult caregivers, many children get missed by agencies that can help.
Connie Siskowski joins us now. She's president and founder of the American Association of Caregiving Youth. Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, Connie, can you tell us how common that is? This is something we don't see that often in public, in the media. How common is it for children to be serving as caregivers?
It's much more common than anyone would imagine. So the only national study that we have showed, which was released in 2005, showed that there were at least 1.3 million children ages 8 to 18 in that role. And when you think about how our country has changed since that time, we know that, and we have seen many more children. We have more single-parent households. We have more grandparents raising grandchildren. The grandparents get sick. The economy has forced households to move together. We have people living longer. We have more advanced technology. given at home, and we have more managed care, and often with more managed care, there is less home care provided.
And Connie, as I understand it, this is not just your job. This was your story, too. You were one of these children who provided care for a relative. Can you share that story?
Sure. So my parents were divorced at a time when parents really didn't get divorced. And we lived with my grandparents, and my grandfather was my buddy. He was my hero. He worked until he was 84, and then his health really started to decline. And it was just a natural thing for me to do, to take care of him. My mom worked a lot. My grandmother just didn't really seem to have the compassion, the caregiving gene, and my brother was involved with his lab in the basement or whatever he was doing. So, like I said, it was my honor and my privilege to help him, but I don't think I was really prepared because I was like 12 years old to do some of the things that he needed me to do in terms of personal care, in terms of I slept in the living room to be closer to his bedroom in case he needed something. And at this time, he was needing medication during the night. When I got up to give him his pill at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was the one who found him no longer breathing. And to this day, I can still feel the coldness of his skin. So it was at a time when trauma in children was just really not recognized. And so it had some long-term effects on me, no longer having, you know, my hero, my buddy, the person who in my family I probably love the most around anymore. And, you know, so that whole trauma stuff really impacted me personally, and I didn't realize it until I was a much older adult.
Well, so many questions come up about the challenges a kid in this situation could face. And let's start with this idea of you at age 12, and we're talking kids a little older, maybe even a little younger, having this enormous responsibility put on them. How do kids cope with this on their own, dealing with maybe an ailing parent or grandparent as you were?
Well, a lot of times they don't deal with it well. And so they become angry, they become frustrated. In fact, in our work, one of our first introductions to one of the students was because she was involved with juvenile justice. Her mom had to call 911 because she was hitting her out of her frustration. They also become isolated because they're not able often to have friends at home or participate in after-school activities. Their academics can suffer. There was a great commercial that said, you know, when you're worried about what's going on at home, it's impossible to think about anything else. And so our original studies back in 2002 when I got my PhD showed that kids were missing school, they weren't completing their homework, they were having trouble focusing, or some combination of those three. And that was more than 4,000 of a group of more than 12,600 middle and high school students.
Talking to Connie Siskowski with the American Association of Caregiving Youth, talking about kids who, for one reason or another, step up into the role of caregiver for maybe an aging or ailing family member. Connie, we don't have a lot of research in numbers, you were saying, about how many kids are out there in this situation. And I'm guessing a lot of these kids are just under the radar, not getting help that they might need. Why is it? Why don't we know how many people are in this situation?
Well, it's not like you go to school, particularly when you're in middle school, and you don't want to be different and say, hey, guess what I did for Grandpa this morning. There's a big fear factor, fear of families being split up if people, you know, in the system knew what the kids were doing. And there's also a sense of pride. You know, we're supposed to take care of this ourselves. Some people don't want other people to help at home. And often there's not the realization of what the child is going through, particularly if that child sees the impact on their own parent, say it's a grandparent, maybe with Alzheimer's disease or whatever, that has moved into the home, and they can see the stress of that parent, and so they want to help, and they don't want to share what's going on with them to cause more worry or even more financial burden if the child needs something special for school, or even we've had kids share eyeglasses because they didn't want their parent to know that they were having trouble seeing.
And Connie, your organization and you are trying to provide help for kids in this situation, mainly in Florida. What kind of things are you doing to try to help them out?
So we work in partnership with the schools, and that's where we identify the kids first in sixth grade. And we do a series of skills-building groups beginning in sixth grade, which is a foundation six-week course once a week, and then continue with a different curriculum up through high school graduation. So we support the kids in school from sixth grade through 12th grade. We help them to reframe and to value themselves, what they're doing, not only in terms of their family, but also to society. We also, in school, do lunch and learn activities where we bring in community resources, and that's open not only for our kids, but often school staff or kids not yet in the program come up, because when we go through the eligibility process, it's a day and time, and life can happen on all those other days. And then we do a home visit for families that will allow us, and that means a social worker will go in to do a home assessment to see what other things are needed. We've helped four families get clean water. We found kids with complaining about their backaches, and we found that, you know, this one boy, for instance, and his single mom were having to lift his brother in a wheelchair in and out of the house because their stoop was too high to have a ramp. And we were able to find somebody to make a ramp. And then we do fun activities. So we have a camp, we call it Camp Treasure, to help the kids know that they're a treasure and to discover the treasure within. We do cooking classes, a fishing trip, holiday celebrations, different activities that are both fun and educational, because, you know, play is an important part of adolescent development, and if that's missing, you got to catch up on it sometime later in life.
We're talking to Connie Siskowski. She's president and founder of the American Association of Caregiving Youth. We're talking about children who take care of sick or aging family members.
And we'll be joined in just a moment by a Wisconsin professor who specializes in researching children in these positions. And we want to hear from you. Is this your story? Or do you know someone who was a child who took care of a family member? Call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also send your thoughts to talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now we're taking your calls on children who serve as caregivers. Millions of children nationwide take care of sick or elderly family members, but many people are unaware of the issues facing kids who are in these situations.
We want to hear from you. Was this your story? Were you a child who took care of a family member? How did that affect you? Or if you work in schools or social work, is this something that you encounter? Do you encounter it often? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And right now we're picking up the conversation with Connie Siskowski. She's the founder and president of the American Association of Caregiving Youth. As a young person, she took care of her aging grandparents and now runs the organization to raise awareness for the topic.
And we're welcoming now Melinda Cavanaugh. She is an assistant professor of social work at the UW-Milwaukee. Her research focuses on the issue of caregiving youth. Melinda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So do we have any sense of how many people in young people in Wisconsin are serving as caregivers?
That's an excellent question, and unfortunately not one that we can answer. One of the things that is missing in the conversation about young caregivers is how many kids out there are doing it, not only nationwide, but on a state level. It's not something that's captured in any sort of caregiving surveys, census data, or any statewide level data. We don't have that. What we do have really is anecdotal data from, you know, school systems and from several of the different research studies that I've done in the state of Wisconsin, you know, that really indicates it's probably a fairly high number, proportionate to even more so than what we have nationwide, around that 1.4 million.
And Melinda, are schools, are organizations out there trying to provide the kind of help that Connie was talking about earlier to try to reach out to these students and then to offer some kind of services?
You know, what's interesting is that when you talk to social work and we talk to school personnel on a one-on-one basis, they acknowledge that these kids exist. They are aware of them being out there and participating in caregiving. One of the kind of limitations or one of the barriers is that there's no systematic programs for these youth. So while the school social worker or the teacher may certainly be aware of it and they may want to do something individually, school systems or programs aren't out there developing broader programs and ways to support these kids. So it's really what we're seeing is more on an individual level rather than a programmatic level. Which is really one area that we really need to tackle to be able to address the issues around these children on a much more broad level.
And Connie, I want to bring you back in on this now.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for schools, even if it's just something ad hoc, to give some kind of outreach to these kids?
So actually, we have, and we're in the process of expanding our affiliate network, where we look to partner with existing nonprofits and essentially a nonprofit franchise model where we can provide our resources and information and development tools as well as resources that we have worked on that we know work to help programs in other states. So there is a survey that's just been done down in North Carolina in Chapel Hill. There are folks out in L.A. Working out of the L.A. Children's Hospital. New Jersey is, for the first time, awarding a youth caregiver in their state an award for their work during National Family Caregivers Month. New York has a couple of programs, and there's a relatively new one in Detroit. So little by little, we're making a difference, mm-hmm. but we really need a national campaign to raise awareness. And we welcome people to contact us to consider becoming affiliates. One of the challenges of working with a school system and not a nonprofit is time, so that caregiving goes on 365 and school is not open. So that's why we prefer to partner with a nonprofit. Although, however, the kids can be recognized and supported, we feel at this point is better than nothing at all.
We're talking about youth who serve as caregivers. We have Melinda Cavanaugh with us, UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor of Social Work, and Connie Siskowski, we're just hearing from her there, founder and president of the American Association of Caregiving Youth. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Peggy is on the line in Madison. Peggy, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
What do you think, Peggy?
I just happened to be leaving an assignment and turned on the radio and was thrilled. I actually could feel my heart pounding when I just heard you talking about the topic. I'm an adult and grew up in a family where my father was physically disabled for many years, most of my childhood, used a wheelchair and had some physical issues going on, and later in life had some strokes that really he became unable to work at that point. We were fortunate up until then that he was able to work. And so I also wanted to comment that sometimes even if the child is not the main caregiver, their life can be heavily impacted if the other parent is the main caregiver. And I think, you know, the family pitches in, you end up giving care, but really my mother is the one who was the main caregiver. And that puts a stress on everyone. It puts a stress on the mother who knows she's not able to spend as much time with their children as she would like, and of course on the children who feel a little bit selfish when they have a need, knowing that there is a parent that sometimes has to and sometimes is given the priority in the family.
Peggy, thanks a lot for that call. Melinda, do you see that in your research, whether we're talking about a child being a main caregiver or part of the story, that there are these conflicts, the pressure it puts on the whole family?
Absolutely. I appreciate so much of what Peggy said, because what that shows is that caregiving and illness is really a family issue, that it's not just that one person is providing care and the other person exists in the family. It's that we see a lot of that in our research, particularly in a study that I did recently in a Latino community on the south side of Milwaukee. A lot of the 77 children who identified themselves as caregivers didn't necessarily identify as being a primary caregiver, but what they did talk about is expectations and stress on the family when the illness was present and the other adults were occupied with caregiving. They were participating in care, but they were also feeling stressed about the loss of interaction, about the lack of communication, the lack of understanding about the disease itself. So caregiving is one piece of it, but not having a cohesive family unit around that experience is another piece of it, particularly when that second parent or the other adult in the home is the main caregiver or also working outside the home.
And Connie, Peggy used the phrase that she felt selfish when she had what I assume was an ordinary kid need, but she felt selfish. And I imagine that's a common thing. People feel selfish or guilty, these kids, for being kids when they have this huge responsibility.
Right. And so that's one of the things that we try and instill in our kids that we work with is self-care. And it doesn't just have to be a parent or a grandparent. It could also be a sibling. We're seeing a bigger increase, particularly with the increased diagnosis of autism and on that spectrum of children who feel apart because the parent, and rightfully so, has to give time, attention, and resources to the child who is not well.
I want to bring in another caller. Thanks to Peggy. We've got Kevin on the line in Janesville now. Kevin, hi.
Hi. As a middle school teacher in some very economically challenged communities, I've seen many of my middle school older siblings being the primary caregiver home at night because parents are working two and three jobs or single-parent homes. Is there any numbers in the data to suggest how many of those kids are out there?
Kevin, thanks. Melinda, is that something you found in your research, kids not caring for parents or grandparents in this case, but for their younger siblings?
Absolutely. It's not something that has been such a direct focus of my research, but kind of in a secondhand way, we do see that kids are responsible. They're carrying a tremendous amount of responsibility, whether there's illness in the home or not, because, you know, someone asked me recently, what is one of the biggest issues with children as caregivers and family parental illness? And I always talk about the economic issue. And it really comes down to economics, what we can afford to provide, what other access and services can we afford to get. And you often have, whether there's caregiving or not, both parents working outside the home. So then the child steps into that, not caregiving for the parent, but caregiving for the child, the other sibling in the home. And that very much, again, relates to this economic issue of what other services or resources can we rely on? And when we can't, we rely on the child. So whether they're caring for the parent or the child, they're stepping up in a way that is often out of their developmental understanding or their developmental comfort zone, which is a stressor on that caregiving youth.
Thanks a lot to Kevin for that call. Connie, you're trying to spread the word on what's really a hidden problem, under-the-radar problem. Do you feel like we're making headway there? Are people recognizing this and talking about it?
Yes, little by little, but it's something that we have to continually raise awareness about, so I so much appreciate the show and opportunity. One of the local government officials said to me one time, well, Connie, maybe they don't want to know, because if people know, then maybe we have to do something about it. So it's time that people do know, and we are seeing more recognition of youth caregiving, and even Melinda with her research that probably 10 years ago would not have happened.
Thanks to both Connie and Melinda for joining us here on Central Time. Connie Siskowski is founder and president of the American Association of Caregiving Youth, and Melinda Cavanaugh is an assistant professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her research specializes in caregiving children. Both joined us today to talk about kids who serve as caregivers and their families and the effects it can have on them. I've got a link, by the way, to some more information. You can find that over at the Central Time Facebook page. And if this is your story, if this has been a part of your life, you can share that there. Again, share your story and find more information about caregiving youth over at the Central Time Facebook page. Pokemon has been around for a long time as a card game, as a TV show, movie, and video games, and now it's taking over virtual reality.
Right, so last week, Nintendo released Pokemon Go. It's an app that lets Pokemon fans use their phones to find and capture the weird Pokemon critters in everyday real-world locations like a coffee shop or a park or an office, maybe here at WPR.
Yeah, police at UW-Madison are asking people to look up from their phones once in a while after reports of the weekend of people walking and biking into traffic during the hunt for elusive Pokemon critters.
This has been highly anticipated in my household, and when I got onto Twitter in the morning, I was a little groggy, but it took me a while to realize I was confusing Ash Carter, Defense Secretary, with Ash Ketchum from Pokemon fame.
Master.
Right. So there's a little bit of crossover there, but I think I got it straight now.
It's all over social media. And in my brief walk out to get some half and half to go with my coffee today, I heard college age kids talking about it, or a producer's report that people are talking about this. They're finding Pokemon in bar outings. Watch for people with glazed looks in their eyes hunting for elusive Pokemon critters.
Do you have a favorite Pokemon?
Charmander is a fun one. I think that's the one that was found at the bar the other day.
Pikachu is an all-time favorite.
Yeah, well, we'll go out with a little inspirational music for you.